Thank you. I'd like to begin with the bad news. Bad for me, but more importantly, it's bad for all of us. In Melbourne, Victoria, Australia, the southern hemisphere of the world. Last year, speaking this podium, I offered the Cedar Faithful a two-part wildcard prediction. Firstly, I said that despite the talk about an American and NATO preemptive strike against Iran's nuclear facilities, it wouldn't come to that. Well, it didn't, did it? There was no military action against Iran's nuclear installations. So you might think I was right on that one. But my reason for that prediction is the problem. My reason was, presented in the second part of that wild card look ahead, there wouldn't have to be military action, I said, because towards the end of 2006, the Mullah's regime in Tehran would collapse under the weight of UN sanctions and an internal uprising led by a dissatisfied middle class and students. I wish, but no such luck. No UN sanctions, no uprising. My wild card was just too wild. Indeed, the opposite has happened, and the mullahs in Tehran are more entrenched in power than ever, having, of course, endless oil at their disposal. Whether President Ahmadinejad stays or is replaced, because as some reports are suggesting he seemed to be a bit of an embarrassment, is really a side issue. What matters is that Iran is now a more significant and more powerful player in the game of nations than it was even a year ago. And that's the bad news. President George Bush understands that only too well. And I'd like to suggest that it explains everything that's happened in relation to Iraq, the United States, George Bush, even Howard and Barack Obama. It explains why he's chosen to raise the number of troops in Iraq. If I can steal Terry's point, it's the Iranians, stupid. Indeed, the key to understanding what lies ahead in 2007 for Iraq, and therefore I might add, to what might unfold in Australia politically between now and the federal elections. That is, I take Terry's point, to the extent that Iraq is a defining issue, probably might be fourth order, fifth order, but it's an issue. To the extent that it is an issue in Australia, track the Iranian connection. A few basic points to try and explain that. For the past year, the Iranians, using their oil wealth, their Shia religious influence in Iraq, their political and military proxies, and in particular their experienced Mujahideen military coordinators, have blocked any hope of a viable coalition government in Baghdad. You don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to understand this. They are the drivers. Their aim, clearly, was to force an American withdrawal and defeat. For a while, it looked as if the Democrat victory in the congressional elections, the Bush administration's political slide, and the Baker-Hamilton report, which we keep hearing about, all those would combine to set up, to use a phrase from the Vietnam days, an elegant bug-out from Iraq. But away from the politics, away from the media, and even away from the Washington Beltway, the Bush administration knew that the United States could not simply begin a precipitous withdrawal of its forces. Just wasn't an option. Because quite apart from the disastrous consequences that would follow inside Iraq, and in a way that was not the central issue, it would have left Iran as the dominant regional power. And that is not an option for the United States, at least not in the short term. It's got to be finessed if it's ever going to happen. And it's certainly not an option for Saudi Arabia, for the Gulf states, and for Israel. So Bush chose to go against expectations and increase the troops. In fact, the 21,000 so-called surge probably won't change the security ground, situation on the ground very much. Although it might help for a while in Baghdad. But then the additional troops were never meant to be a military solution. It was Washington telling Tehran, don't assume you've figured us out. And it was Washington wanting to have some more bargaining chips on the table so it could deal from a position of strength if it had no choice but to end up negotiating with the Iranians, which is, of course, what Baker Hamilton says should be happening. And in a kind of perverse way, it explains why, over recent weeks, the United States has gone public with its denunciations of Iran. And some of these denunciations have come from Bush himself. Bush has identified himself directly with what the Americans have known for a long time has been the Iranian involvement in what's going on in Iraq. Their support for terrorism and violence is every bit as important as what Al-Qaeda or Sunni insurgents, as what Shia-Sunni violence might be doing, because someone has to foment it, and a state power with money, the training of these coordinators and the people directly involved, that's what counts. The point is, Iranian involvement wasn't news to the Americans. They've chosen to ratchet up the heat on the Iranians now as part of this so-called surge strategy. So as I see it, there are now two scenarios for 2007. In one scenario, the Americans will somehow hold the line in Iraq. The Iranians will back off somewhat, and while the security situation won't improve, it won't get dramatically worse. It's bad, bad, bad. Crisis, disaster, catastrophe, call it what you like. But in this scenario, don't be surprised if, despite it being a non-starter now, and it is a non-starter now, there could indeed be some tentative moves towards the end of the year on negotiations with Iran along Baker Hamilton lines, but Iraq won't be the only item on the agenda. The agenda will be both Iraq and Tehran's nuclear ambitions. But there's a second scenario. In this second scenario, the Iranians may decide to overplay their hand both in Iraq and on the nuclear front. Then the already anxious and very nervous Saudis, the very nervous Jordanians, the deeply disturbed and nervous Gulf states, not to mention a profoundly troubled Israel, will ratchet up their pressure on Washington, in which case the Americans, directly and indirectly through their proxies in the Middle East, will indeed shift gear on regime change in Tehran. As for the weakness of the Bush administration, which is real enough, its lame duck status, I believe, wouldn't really prevent it from bringing real pressure to bear on Iran, even including military intervention, if that became the only option. Well, having spent virtually half my time on Iraq, Iran and Washington, let me now try to explain why I don't think that the Middle East, Iraq, and the war between the United States and its allies against jihadist terror is the most important feature of the international landscape that lies ahead of us. And here there is another test of your memory. I've already confessed what I got wrong about Iran, but you may remember that I said last year that jihadist terror and its implications around the world would indeed be a main feature of the international landscape. Well, it was and it wasn't, but in my own revised thinking about it, I got the relationship between Iran and jihadist terror wrong. Well, wrong to this extent. I happened to be in Israel in June into July when just on the eve of the war against Lebanon. And my own thinking about the role of Iran in the Middle East in the light of what happened with Hezbollah as its proxy in Lebanon, the role that Hezbollah has played as part of the government in Lebanon has made me think again about how effective. It's cost them hundreds of millions, maybe billions certainly, of dollars to build Hezbollah up. But Iran has taken the long view. It started building Hezbollah up 25 years ago. And it's now beginning to reap the rewards as it's now trying to maneuver Hamas as well. It's not just about Israel. Israel is the proxy for the West and the United States, and beyond that, Iran's strategic realpolitik to really dominate all of the Middle East, and of course the oil wealth that comes with that. Well, as I say, having spent virtually half my time, I want to now say, those aren't, as I see it now, the big dominant issues which will govern the international scene. Before I develop that theme, I'd like to ask you all a question, a genuine question, and then offer you three different ways of looking at the global picture ahead. The question is, what are we doing here? Why are we here? Well, whatever you may think are the reasons you're here, and whatever the reasons Richard and Terry think they're here, let me tell you why all of us are really here. We're here because we have no choice, none of us. That's because trying to predict and imagine the future, which is what Richard, Terry and I are trying to do, and trying to satisfy your need to know that future, which is what you're trying to do, is imprinted on our human DNA. At least, I figure it must be. And just as the life scientists say they've found a selfish gene and a generous gene, it won't be long before they find the futurist gene in all of us. So there. Don't ever say that I'm reluctant to share a CETA overview as trade secrets. Another, I suppose, trick when hopelessly wrong in my predictions is to divert attention from what was brought us. They're nowhere near the dangers to our very existence or to civilization as we know it that they've been made out to be. Even if Islamic terrorists use a nuclear weapon, he says, of course it would be terrible, but it would not be the end of the world. It wouldn't compare to the destruction of a nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union, which would have killed 160 to 180 million people in the first 24 hours, and the nuclear winter that would have followed could well have meant the end of the human race. That was an existential threat. No terrorist threat, Dib argues, is comparable to that. Now, of course, Dib is a realist. More than that, he's an old-fashioned balance of power man. He doesn't believe that all that matters is business and trade and economic growth, and that war between nation states is somehow obsolete, and that terrorism somehow or other is all the go in terms of military threat. So he emphasizes what he calls one of the most remarkable shifts, those are his words, one of the most remarkable shifts in the balance of power in world history, which we're about to experience. The center of the gravity of world power is shifting from Europe and the North Atlantic to Asia, no news in that. But, he says, the rise of China and India, the fact that Asia has never experienced a strong China and a strong Japan and a strong India at the same time, risks a collision of great power interests. And all that is happening at the same time as a resurgent Russia is reappearing on the world stage as the world's largest producer of natural gas, which, of course, it's already using to squeeze the Ukraine and half of Europe, and as the second largest producer of oil. So there they are, the trio, transnational environmental end of the world assessment, a moralist that says there are far more important things to worry about in humanity than climate change, and a realist who, in a way, really is telling us it's back to the future. Well, if I have to choose, I'm with Paul Dibb. In 2007, whatever the soup of the day that the media and the political classes in the West will serve up, whatever this week's or next week's or next month's existential threat might be to mankind, I believe after about 15 years of it being very much a unipolar world, we're moving now to a multipolar world. Not quite there yet. The United States is still out there, but there are now significant other players in what I would call the great power game. And that will include Iran, of course, in a regional sense, because there we have power combining with a pernicious ideology, as we had historically with Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. Communism is one thing, but communism and the Soviet Union, communism and China. Nazism and fascism were one thing, but Nazism combined with a resurgent Germany after World War I, and an empowered Italy, fascism. Those were the threats. They will, again, if pernicious ideology takes over elsewhere, but it's certainly there in Iran, is what makes Iran a danger. And, of course, the United States is going to have to juggle in all this. It's not going to give up its hegemonic role easily. As to what all that will mean, well, I won't make any predictions this time. After all, as the editor of the Wilson Quarterly put it so nicely, I want to retain some magic and in that way further the great human conversation. Thank you very much.